See, I won't give the namo this evening. I'm not going to give a dhammadesana, but this evening I would like to introduce the forthcoming biography of our teacher, Lumpo Cha, give a little bit of background, and then to read a few selected passages. So this biography, which will be called Stillness Flowing, The Life and Teachings of Ajahn Chah, is based upon the official Thai biography of Lumpo Cha called Upalamani, which was published in 1993 and distributed for the first time at the funeral of Lumpo. So that in that book, I was dealing with a lack of confidence in my Thai prose style, and so I tried to turn my weak point into the strong point of the book by using a lot of direct quotations. I categorized Lumpo Cha's Dhamma talks and then selected one talk of each category. For instance, there's a particular genre of talks given after the Patimokkha recitation, which are generally focused upon the sila. And there's one, the genre or the scolding desana genre, and the desana that I included and is now to be found in the collected teachings of Ajahn Chah under the title Toilets on the Path. So there are a lot of full-length desanas and a lot of quotations from disciples and family members and so on. Just a note on, so one or two points perhaps of interest. This was before days of computers, and we had I think towards the end, an electric typewriter, but I used a cut and paste method, which involved having a typewritten page photocopied many times and then cutting it with scissors and pasting passages onto other bits of paper, and then writing longhand in the gaps between the printed, pasted sections, and then photocopying them again, and so on. So it was a very time-consuming process. The for those of you who might be interested, the title Upalamani, the word Ubon, the name of the city nearest to Wat Bapong, is derived from the Pali word which we would pronounce as Upala. So it's a lotus. It's a kind of lotus. And so the title is a kind of play on words. So Lumpo Cha was the money or the jewel in the lotus, and also the jewel of Ubon. Those kind of play of words. At that time, I had a lay supporter who was a fine poet and a teacher in the local college, and he had suffered a terrible car accident and was paraplegic. But his mind was still very sharp. And so I was thinking of ways to cheer him up, and I used to go every 10 days to his house, and he was the person who taught me how to write Thai poetry. So he was my Thai poetry teacher, and so I asked him what he thought about this title Upalamani, and for some obscure poetic reasons, I don't know, he suggested to change the bo by mai to bo bla. So it's for those Thai members of the audience, it became bo bla mani. So the structure of the book that I devised for Palamani is more or less reproduced in the new book, although there's a shuffling of some chapters and some amalgamated and one or two shorter ones omitted. one point I'd like to make is that there is very little biographical information about Dumpo Cha, particularly in the years preceding the establishment of Wat Bapong. And in most biographies of the great masters in Thailand, almost the first, one of the first few pages, there'll be a chronological list of the monasteries or the places in which he spent the rains retreat. And this was completely absent for Lumpo Cha, the sort of proto-biography which was written in the late 60s by Lumpo Mahamon was just a collection of kind of random anecdotes, and there was no chronological list. So a lot of the chronology that appears in the book is from my own kind of detective work, trying to put together snippets of information from here and there, and looking on a map and working out how it could all fit together. And just this year, I realized I made a mistake in Upalamani, and going back over an old document, I found that Lumpur refers to the rains retreat he spent at Lumpur Ginri's monastery, one of his teachers. And he says that he just mentions in passing that it was the Adhikamasa year, that's to say the year in which the lunar calendar adds an extra month, or it's called Bat Songhorn. And so I was able to check that and found out it was 1948 rather than 1947, as I previously assumed. And so I made that change. So a lot of the early stuff is, I must admit, to be speculation. But it's as good as it can get. So this evening, I'm going to read a few selected passages. So the book begins with the death of Lumpo Cha and his funeral. And then we go back in time, and the second chapter, which many of you will be familiar with, at least in an earlier draft, is called Early Days. Let me tell you a bit about how the genesis of this book. So going back to the funeral itself of Lumpo Cha, after spending a year both running Wat Nanachat as the senior monk and writing this book in this very difficult way with a lot of stress to get it finished in time. And one of the great helpers in this project was Ajahn Jatomalo, who's here. He was helping with all the photographs and the artwork. And so by the time the cremation took place, I was absolutely exhausted. And the only thing I have thought about books, never again will I get involved in such a big topic. Meanwhile, Ajahn Pasan, Lumpur Pasan, have been working even harder than me over at Wat Bapong. And I have this memory of the night, I think it was the night after the funeral, and we were sitting in his kuti, and we had some chocolate, which was not, you know, as easily available as it is these days, quite a treat. And we were both out on our feet, and he was... and I was massaging his feet in a kind of rather desultory way. And I don't know if you remember this, Lumpur Pasno fell asleep while I was massaging his feet. And when he woke up, the chocolate was still in his mouth. That's how tired he was, yeah. So anyway, I I was never again. But then, you know, so, oh, it'd be so good if we had this in English, and we really, you know, people all around the world. And so, so I got persuaded. And in 1996, I did like a sabbatical, almost a year, in which I wrote that early days chapter, which has been circulated, as they say, in an early form, and rough versions of a number of the other chapters. Following that, Lumpur Pasno went to America. I was the Jawat at Wat Banana Chat, and then pretty well put it on the back burner. And in fact, the pilot light went out altogether. And after I had finished my five-year term and was able to move into a beautiful hermitage, then I just didn't feel like writing and using my brain in that way for many years, really. And then I started to sort of pick it up and do a little bit and sort of get enthusiastic for a while, and then the enthusiasm would wane, as being a Sankara, as we all know. And it just went on like this. So everyone here who knows about this has been extremely patient, and Lumpur Pasno has always been giving me this support, and he's never got on my case, but he's always says, he sees me once a year or so, and he's got his writing. Any news on the book? You know, it's like, so he never tried to make me feel guilty or anything. But anyway, this is somehow years and years went by with me sort of feeling that this manuscript was kind of like an old friend on my laptop. And I sort of think of Lumpur Char and miss him and just open up and do a little bit on the book. And it wasn't really going anywhere until a year or two ago, Lumpur Biek asked me about it. And he was keen to produce something in time in order for Lumpur's name to be put forward, to be put on the UNESCO list of spiritual leaders or something. And that was when I got back into working on it in a more systematic way. And now with the 100th anniversary coming up next year, then much more of a deadline. And so at last, the finishing line is in sight. And I've still got a lot of work to do, which is why you may not see me around these days. Every spare minute, I'm still in my room working on this, on the editing and rewriting of certain passages in the book. But it's the plan is that it will be published in Kuala Lumpur in September, and shipped out here and probably arriving in the new year, but there will be copies for the monasteries which will come ahead of that towards the end of the year. So, okay, that's the introduction. I'm going to read a few passages and to give a kind of a representative selection. I'm starting off with one of the really sort of gung-ho passages from... so this is, I think... Of the passages I've chosen, this is the only direct translation from Lumpur himself. I'm not sure whether this is in collected teachings or not, at least some version of it. So, okay. Speaking to his disciples many years later, Lumpur spoke fondly of his Tudong years. In those days, I didn't even have a water filter. Requisites were very hard to come by. I had a tiny aluminium dipper that I was very possessive of. I still smoked in those days. There were no matches then, but I had a bamboo tinder box with half a lemon skin as a cap. At night time, when I was weary from walking meditation, I'd sit down and light a cigarette. I reckon if there were any spirits around, the sound of striking that flit, bok, bok, in the middle of the night would have frightened them all away. When I look back on the days when I was practicing alone, it was painful and full of the most challenging ordeals, but at the same time, I really enjoyed it. The enjoyment and the suffering went together, pretty much the same as eating grilled paikar leaves dipped in chili sauce and ground ginger. It's delicious, but it's hot. You're eating it and the snot's flowing down, but you can't stop because it tastes so good. You're eating away, and at the same time, you're groaning, oh, oh. That's what the practice was like in those days. You have to be really resolute to practice Dhamma. It's not a light thing. It's heavy. You have to put your life on the line. A tiger's going to eat you. An elephant's going to trample you. Then so be it. You think like that. When you've kept your precepts purely, there's nothing more to worry about. It's as if you're already dead. If you die, then it's as if there's nothing to die, and so you're not afraid. This is called the weapon of Dhamma. I've been on mountaintops all over the country, and this single weapon of Dhamma has always triumphed. You completely let go. You're bold. You risk your life. You're ready to die. As I thought about it, I saw how the weapon of the Buddha strengthens the mind. It's the best of all weapons. I kept reflecting, looking, thinking, seeing. When the mind truly sees, it penetrates things completely. Suffering is like this. The cessation of suffering is like this. And so there's ease and contentment. Someone who sees suffering but doesn't penetrate right through it, who's content with feelings of inner peace, they have no way of knowing this. If someone is unafraid of death, if they're ready to give their life, then they won't die. Let suffering go beyond suffering and it comes to an end. Comprehend it. See the truth of things. See the nature of things. That has real value. It makes the mind powerful. Do you think it would be possible for such a mind to be afraid of anybody, to be afraid of the forest, to be afraid of wild animals? It is staunch and strong. The heart of a meditation monk is incredibly resolute. Through meditation, anybody who is ready to give their life for the Dhamma develops a mind that is great in size and scope, utterly firm. The ability to let go becomes sublime. All this is called vitakka, raising something up in the mind, and then vichara, investigating it. These two things keep working together until the matter is fully penetrated. At this point, piti, rapture, arises in the mind. My hair stood on end. As I thought of practicing walking meditation or the virtues of the Buddha or the Dhamma, the rapture seeped through my whole body and thoroughly refreshed it. As I sat there, my mind overflowed with joy in my actions, all the obstacles I'd overcome, and my hair stood on end and tears started to fall. I felt even more inspired to struggle and persevere. There was no question of discouragement arising, whatever happened. There was initial and sustained application of the mind, rapture and a bliss accompanied by awareness. The mind was upheld by initial and sustained application of mind, stabilized by the bliss. At that moment, you could say it was dependent on the power of jhana, if you like. I don't know. That's just how it was. If you want to call it jhana, go ahead. But before long, vitakka and vichara were abandoned. Piti disappeared, and the mind had a single focus. Samadhi was firmly established, and the peace that is a foundation for wisdom had arisen. So I gained the insight that it's through practice that knowing and seeing take place. Studying and thinking about it is something else altogether. Even the thoughts and assumptions you make about how things will be are included in the things that you see clearly, and they are revealed to be in contradiction with the way things are. So now I was content. Fat or thin, healthy or ill, I was content. I never wondered where my mother was or whether this or that friend or relation was. There was none of that. I just resolved in my mind that if I died, then I died, and that was all there was to it. I had no worries. That was how firm my mind was. And so there was no more holding back. My mind was invigorated and pushed me on. However many Dhamma talks you listen to, however much you study, the knowledge you gain from that doesn't take you all the way to the truth, and so it can never free you of doubts and hesitation. You have to practice. If your knowledge is a realization of the truth, then things come to a conclusion. I don't know how you'd put it into words, but it just happens naturally. It's inevitable. It's nothing other than the arising of the natural mind, the pakati citta. So the next section is the beginning of the third chapter of the book, which deals with the establishment of Wat Pa Phong. It was on the 8th of March, 1954, that Lumpo Cha and his disciples made their way along the cart track running westwards from Ban Gor on the last leg of their journey to Pong Forest. Afternoon temperatures at that time of year regularly exceed 35 degrees, but the oppressive heat would have cooled slightly as they approached the dense forest and the path became increasingly stippled and striped by shade. In the late afternoon, as the gorged red sun was starting its descent ahead of them, the monks strung up their glots at the edge of the forest amid the hum of mosquitoes and the deafening shrill of cicadas. Pong Forest held strong associations for Lungpo. An abiding memory of his childhood was of his father walking there one morning with some friends to offer alms to the great Lungpo Sao, who was camped out in the forest practicing meditation. That evening, the young child listened with fascination to his father's account of their expedition. It was the first time he had heard about wandering monks living austere lives in the jungle. He always remembered how impressed his father had been that Lungpo Sao ate all his food from his alms bowl rather than from plates, as the village monks did. And he also recalled his father's slight puzzlement at Lungpo Sao's teaching style. "It wasn't like a proper sermon at all," he said. "It was just like normal talking." Many years later, Lungpo said, "When I set off and started practicing, the memory of my father's account was constantly with me. Whenever I came back home to visit, my mind would always turn to this forest." Ajahn Dee from Pibun and Lungpo Put once passed through there, and the villagers invited them to stay. Lungpo Put still speaks of it to this day. Ajahn Dee said, "This isn't our place. We can't stay. It won't be long now, and the owner will arrive." The following morning, after finishing their daily meal, the group of monks entered the thickly tangled forest for the first time. Villagers from Ban Gor moved in front of them, expertly hacking away through the stubborn vines and luxurious undergrowth with their machetes. Eventually, at the cool heart of the forest, they halted. No photographs were taken of this auspicious occasion. It is unlikely that anyone present that day had even seen a camera, much less used one. But imagination may supply a picture. The wiry villagers, sweat running down the protective spells tattooed on their chests, squatting in a circle and rolling cigarettes. Lungpo at the foot of an ancient and imposing mango tree, the monks sitting some distance apart, drinking water from their bamboo flasks, and tranquility from the air around them. A group of women had been following in the monks' wake. They soon joined their menfolk in methodically removing all the vines, stumps, and thorns in the neighborhood of the old mango tree. Clearing land was work at which the villagers were adept, and a central open area soon started to take shape amongst the larger shade-bearing trees, creating a neat, stately, and almost park-like atmosphere in the midst of the thick and matted jungle that surrounded them. At the foot of some of the larger trees, beyond the edge of this area, small squares of land were cleared for the monks to set up their glots. The monks themselves, forbidden by the Vinaya to dig the earth or destroy plant life, helped by dragging the cut branches into the forest and sweeping the cleared areas. There was a break at midday for the villagers to eat their lunch, sticky rice and fermented fish brought from home, and fresh forest leaves gathered along the way. Then, with the sun overhead filtering down between the large patches of shade in bright, hot pools, it was back to the steady rhythm of the work. By late afternoon, a rudimentary path had been cut to the edge of the forest. After taking their leave of Lungpo, the lay people made their way along this new path for the first time, hurrying a little in order to reach their homes before dark. In the heart of the forest, as darkness set in, the monks and their glots sat in meditation. Early one morning, a few days later, a group of volunteers from Ban Gor and Ban Glang arrived to build huts for the monks and expand the open area. They brought with them sections of thin yakar thatch for the roofs and cut the main posts and beams from the trees around them. The men deftly split bamboo into long strips to weave into floors, while the women attached large dry chart leaves to bamboo frames for the walls. Four huts were completed by the evening, simple dwellings but sufficient for the monks' needs. The flimsiness of these shelters could not conceal their significance. Their creation, in the space of a day, had transformed the monk's presence in the forest from that of respectful guests of its peace and shade into settlers. So the next passage I'd like to read is from section on the Vinaya. So the early days chapter dealing with Lumpur's childhood, youth, and his Tudong years. So there's this chapter which I've just read the first paragraphs dealing with the establishment of Wat Bapong. And then there is an overview of Lumpur's personality and his role as a Kalyana Mitta. And then the book starts to go into more detail in the training that Lumpur Cha provided. So there is a chapter dealing with the Vinaya, Khor Wat, the monastic regulations, and the Tudonga Wat. Then there's a chapter on the monk's life, including things to do with preparing for ordination, accepting Akanduka monks. There's a whole there's a section on the psychology of disrobing, which I don't think has appeared in print before, and so many different aspects of monk's life. And then there's a chapter on Lumpur's teaching of meditation. And then there's a chapter on his teaching of the Western Sangha. There's a teaching of the Mechi, and then a teaching of the lay people. And following that, there is the chapter on the last years of Lumpur's life and his illness and the long bedridden years preceding his death. And then the last chapter is sort of rewind and deals with his two trips to the West, where we see Lumpur in his pomp, as it were. So the next section is short section from the chapter on Vinaya. All the offerings received by monks at Wat Bapong were relinquished to a central store. When a monk needed a requisite, new torch batteries, for instance, soap, toothpaste, or razor blades, he would request it from the monastery storekeeper, who was usually, and not coincidentally, one of the gruffest and most intimidating monks in the monastery. The storekeeper was empowered to refuse to hand over requisites if there was evidence that monks were using them extravagantly. Frugality was considered a hallmark of the true forest monk and was much praised by Lumpur. The recollection that all of their possessions were gifts of faith to be used with a clear awareness of purpose featured in the verses chanted by every monk in the morning and evening chanting. One monk recalled, "During the time that I lived with Lumpur, there weren't any shortages of the important requisites, but the distribution of them was very strict. If your robe wasn't falling to pieces, you weren't given permission to change it. It was a little more relaxed for senior monks, but for the junior monks and novices or visiting monks, it was especially strict. Lumpur emphasized that we trained to be moderate in our needs, and he lived no differently than anyone else. He wore the same quality robes, and there was nothing much to distinguish his kuti's furnishings from anybody else's. Even though his family lived close by, he never asked them for anything for himself. Whatever he was offered, he shared with the Sangha." This communal system was aimed at promoting fairness and equality in the use of requisites, and Lumpur saw it as vital to the maintenance of social harmony. By forbidding monks from accepting offerings, even when specifically intended for them, he did much to prevent jealousy and competition for lay support amongst his disciples. As the number of branch monasteries increased, surplus requisites were funneled to them, preventing Wat Bapong from ever becoming too luxurious as its fame and attendant wealth increased. The advent of stainless steel bowls in the mid-1970s created a fresh object of desire for younger members of the Sangha. The new bowls, free from the threat of rust, were easier to look after. They were much lighter than the old bowls, and they seemed cool and modern. almost everybody wanted one. But if a monk made a request to replace his old bowl out of a hope for an upgrade to one of the new stainless steel bowls, rather than from genuine need, he would come to regret it. In such cases, Lumpur was known to order that the monk be given the ugliest second-hand iron bowl in the store. On one occasion, a monk must have been unable to conceal his chagrin at this turn of events, because Lumpur, observing him, said, "The only ugly thing here is the greed you've shown." Monks' cravings for a particular type of cloth, a particular kind of alms bowl, a crocheted alms bowl cover, or even a particular brand of spoon may seem bizarre at first, and then even a little sad. It prompts the question, what is the value of renunciation of worldly possessions if the renunciant merely transfers his attachments to more humble objects? Surely attachment is attachment, whatever its object. And if that is so, aren't monks deceiving themselves? Lumpur did not consider a drastically simplified lifestyle to be liberating in itself. He knew well enough that the tendency towards attachment is far too strongly embedded in the unenlightened mind to be so simply bypassed. But a life pared back to essentials did play an important part in the training he was providing. Firstly, because it was a key element in sustaining the distinctive culture and identity of the renunciant forest monk. Secondly, because the nature of attachment, its impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and impersonality, is revealed far more readily when focused on a few simple objects than when dispersed amongst a wide variety of desirable things available in lay life. Thus, Lumpur constantly urged monks to keep reviewing the nature of their relationship with the requisites and to be alert to the arising of defilement in order to give them a perspective on these attachments. For the monks who followed his advice, coarse attachments to good quality requisites tended to fade away quite quickly. After a few years, most monks would look back at their robe or bowl obsessions with wry good humor. Reflections on the responsible use of the requisites were a staple of Lumpur's regular pep talks to the monks. "Householders make their living with the sweat of their brow," he said, "through trials and adversity, and they still give up a portion of their income to buy food and other requisites for the Sangha. If you take that for granted," he said, "if you take it to be your right and use their offering selfishly or mindlessly, you are creating very bad karma indeed." So the next reading is from the chapter on the Mechis of Wapapong. And one point that's not included in this passage is that Lumpur consistently referred to Mechis as summoners. He said, "You're all summoners here. Monks, novices, Mechis, you're all summoners." So he gave a great deal of respect to the Mechis, and there were some very good practitioners in the Wat Pa Pong Sangha at that time. Lumpur had seen in other monasteries how competition for the teacher's attention amongst the resident Mechis could lead to jealousies that undermined the harmony of their community. He maintained a strictly impartial stance towards them. Many of the nuns were especially impressed by how he refrained from singling out his mother for any special attention or privileges. In the culture in which they lived, the willingness to treat one's mother as just one member of a larger group was seen as a truly impressive achievement. This impartiality was not a blanket indifference. On the contrary, he showed a consistent concern for the welfare of every one of the Mechis. Mechi Bunyu says, "The monastery was still quite unknown then, and not many people came to offer food. Usually the only fruit we would have would be the small amount that came from the Mechis' garden. One day a group of lay people came to help with a work project. One of them planted a pineapple shoot near the kitchen, and it grew up into a pineapple. Very big it was too, like the ones that nowadays they bring up from the southeast. Pineapples were rare then. Every day when we went to the kitchen, we'd look at the pineapple and be thinking how big it was becoming and wondering when it was ripe, what Lumpur would have done with it. All of us were looking forward to taste it because we'd never eaten a pineapple before in our lives. Then one day the pineapple disappeared. Oh no, I wailed in my mind. Where's it gone? Meshi Bunyu found out the next morning the pineapple had appeared in the kitchen, neatly cut into 15 equal pieces, one for each of the 8 monks and 7 Mechis in the monastery. Lumpur was not idealistic about sense restraint. For monastics training themselves to detach from sense pleasures, enjoyment outlives indulgence and is supplanted by equanimity through insight, not by acts of will. For almost all the members of a monastic community subsisting on a bare diet, a slice of an exotic fruit is a treat. Lumpur did not condemn it as worldly foolishness and was content to assure that everyone in the community had an equal share in this treat, including the Mechis. It was this kind of all-encompassing consideration, one that belied his forbidding demeanor, that endeared him to the Mechis. Lumpur's concern for the Mechis was very apparent to the monks, not least in his regular exhortations on the fair distribution of food. He would remind them to always bear in mind the hard work and sacrifice of the Mechis that made possible the meals they ate, and to make sure that there was always sufficient food sent back to the kitchen. It would be very bad karma if they took so much that those who had prepared the food went without. The emphasis on fairness and impartiality extended to all of the requisites. Meshi Bunyu recalled the distribution of cloth. She said, Lumpur would distribute the cloth himself. After he'd arranged a pile for each nun, the bell would be rung and the Mechi would go up to the raised seat in order of seniority and take her cloth. Afterwards, we'd compare the number of pieces, the quality of the cloth, its fineness or coarseness, and they would all be exactly the same. So now I'd like to skip to the chapter on the lay community and teaching the lay community. And there's a couple of, there's actually 3 readings. It has been customary since the time of the Buddha for monks to visit lay people as they lay on their deathbed to help them leave this world for the next one in the best possible way. In the last hours of his life, Po Puong, one of Lumpur's closest lay disciples, received such a visit. Po Puong and his wife Met Dang were the first lay supporters of Wat Pa Pong to come from the local town of Warin. After spending a rains retreat as a monk, Po Puong asked to disrobe, saying that the monastery still lacked many necessities, and he wanted to encourage other people from Warin to help him raise the necessary funds. Before long, he had arranged the purchase of a monastery bell, and sometime later, he offered a large grandfather clock for the Dhamma Hall. His greatest joy was to come when he, his family and friends, sponsored the casting of the brass Buddha statue that became the central feature of the Wat Pa Pong Dhamma Hall. After he disrobed, Po Puong would still go to the Wat every observance day, keep the 8 precepts, and listen to Dhamma. As his health declined in his later years, he offered to donate his skeleton to the monastery after his death as a memento mori, and asked Lumpur to pick up his body straight after his death and to prepare the skeleton in the monastery. At the beginning of 1963, when his doctors announced that there was nothing more they could do for him, Po Puong's family took him out of the hospital to spend the last days of his life at home. On the 12th of January, Po Puong's condition suddenly became much worse. He became unable to speak or open his eyes. He lay on his bed groaning incessantly. His wife and children sat with him, but were unable to relieve his pain. On the 13th of January, Lumpur, together with Ajahn Jan and a number of other monks, were offered their daily meal in the local army camp. After the meal was over, Lumpo told Colonel Sombun, the commanding officer, that he wanted to visit Port Puang and asked if he could arrange a truck. The colonel said he would order a smaller, more comfortable vehicle, but Lumpo repeated that a truck would be fine. Poor Nu, a lay attendant, asked him whether he was going to visit Port Puang or pick up his corpse. Lumpo said, pick up the corpse. Poor Nu was puzzled. How are you going to do that? He's still alive. Do you think his family will just give him to you? He said to pick his body up after he's dead, didn't he? Lumpo was silent for a moment, and then he said, alive or dead, we're picking him up today. Before turning to Ajahn Chah, let's go. Poor Puang is waiting. It was 12:45 p.m. when they arrived at Poor Puang's house and found him lying on his bed surrounded by his family. Lumpo sat down on the bed, looking at the dying man for a few moments. Then he stroked his face gently, calling him, Poor Puang, Poor Puang. After some time, Poor Puang opened his eyes and turned his head towards Lumpo. Poor Puang, do you know who I am? Poor Puang nodded his head and looked at Lumpo. While groaning sounds still came from his mouth, tears started to flow down his cheeks. Lumpo put his hand on the old man's forehead and started to speak to him in a gentle but firm voice. Poor Puang, you're a practitioner. You've been fighting this for a long time. When it's time for death to take your life, let it go. It belongs to death anyway. Why are you so possessive of it? You've borrowed something, now you've got to return it. Keep the sound inside. Why are you letting it out? As Lumpo finished speaking, Poor Puang's groaning immediately ceased. Lumpo continued, the body is impermanent and unreliable. It's not beautiful. It's old. You've used it for a long time. Go and look for a new body in that place you saw in your vision when you were a monk. All this time, Lumpo was stroking Poor Puang's face. He turned to Colonel Sombun. What time is it? 12:55, sir. Another 5 minutes and he'll be gone. Lumpo kept stroking Poor Puang's face. At exactly 1 o'clock, dying man's eyes drooped and closed. Poor Puang had died at peace. So the next passage is a slightly different tone, and I have to warn listeners that there are one or two rather crude words in this passage, but they are not gratuitous. They are all essential to the narrative, so I hope it'll be okay. So this passage is called Killing the Defilements of Da Sui. After Lumpo became abbot of Wat Bapong, he did not completely abandon the practice of Tudong. In the early years, in particular, when he was still in good health and there were few monks in the monastery, every now and again he would simply walk out of Wat Bapong and into the countryside. Usually he would take monks with him, occasionally laymen. One of the laymen who accompanied him on such journeys later became a monk, and one of the best-loved and colorful characters in the Sangha. Sui had been a larger-than-life figure in the local community before meeting Lumpo. His dissolute and criminal lifestyle earning him the title of Nak Leng. His greed was legendary, and in his old age, he had many stories to tell about how Lumpo has set about taming the coarse fellow he had once been. So Da Sui takes up the story. He took us on Tudong out to Buntarik. There were half a dozen of us to start with, but two ran away on the first night. As the days wore on, more and more ran away until in the end, there was only me left. I was homesick. He said he'd take me for a year, and the more I wanted to go back, the further he'd take me. I just gave in, took what came. Wherever we went, I'd always have my eyes out for s'mores. So for those of you who don't know, this very bitter laxative fruit, which are allowables. Monks can eat them after lunch. One night, he made me sleep by a bamboo clump, even though it was obviously the local toilet place and stunk of excrement. As the dew fell, the smell got even worse. When I complained, he scolded me. Don't make such a fuss. There's more crap in your intestines than there is out there. Excuse me for that. We reached Kumeung, and I came across a beautiful samoa tree. He told me to climb up and shake the branches. The samoas cascaded down. I made a bundle for them in my pakoma cloth. So now I had to carry Lumpur's bowl and the samoas and his shoulder bag, which was also heavy. Lumpur didn't carry anything at all. As we walked along, I wanted to throw some of the samoas away, but then we came to another tree, even more bountiful than the last one, and Lumpur had me collect another great pile. I thought he would help me to carry something, but he refused. I tasted a few of the samoas from the first tree, a few from the second tree, and diarrhea came on in a big way. My bags were too bulky and heavy to put down in time. Lumpur had to teach me the field method. There's no need to sit down, stand and grasp hold of a tree. Crap like a water buffalo. You can do that, can't you? So I stood and defecated until my bowels were empty. 10 o'clock at night, and we were still walking. He wouldn't rest. We reached a stream, and he crossed it on a dead tree. I couldn't manage that and waded through the stream. The water was deep, my baggage was heavy, and I couldn't get up the other bank. Lumpur had to climb down and drag me up. It was midnight before he would stop walking, and I was completely soaked. "This is so much suffering," I groaned. "You've come on this trip to see suffering so that you can go beyond it." Lumpur said this as if it would be some kind of comfort to me. It's through seeing suffering that you become wise. I was exhausted. As he spoke, I started to drift off to sleep, and so he scolded me again. "I'm giving you a teaching and you fall asleep." But as I lay there, I noticed he was using my pakamal cloth to drive the mosquitoes away from my body. I slept for a long time. Whenever I opened my eyes, he was still sitting there. I couldn't help asking him, "Lumpur, aren't you tired? You haven't lain down at all." He said, "The more tired I am, the better the meditation." And then he had another go at me. "People without a thought in their heads are only interested in lying about. Even when you set them an example, they don't take it." "Oh, come on, I'm tired." I couldn't stop myself arguing with him. Finally, I asked him if we could go back. "All right, if that's what you want." He must have seen that I really was far gone. The next morning, Lumpur and Dasa took the road back to the monastery. A car passed. This is Dasa again. A car passed. In those days, there weren't any proper roads. Cars had to go along the buffalo tracks. When he saw us, the driver stopped and ran over to us to invite us to go with him. Lumpur gave his grunt of assent, and I prepared to get into the car. But no. The driver came over to repeat his invitation. Lumpur gave his grunt of assent again, but he made no move to get into the car, and it drove off without us. When I started grumbling, Lumpur turned on me. "Have you come to ride in cars or walk on tudong?" "Couldn't we at least have given him the bag of samoas? And how do we know where he's going?" By now I was getting angry. The car was moving farther and farther away. "Lumpur, are you trying to kill me or what?" "Of course," he replied, quick as a flash. "I've brought you with me to kill your defilements. Everything that comes out of your mouth is defilement. If you don't come and do something like this, then how will you ever be free from defilements? Try lying around doing nothing and see if you get liberated. All that had happened will be that suffering will overwhelm you. Suffering has to be known before you can go beyond it and realize happiness. I brought you to make merit, to look for merit. Do you see that or not? Merit and defilement both lie within us. Cravings never come to an end. You make 10 baht, you want 100. You get 100, you want 1,000. Now look, your craving has stopped because you feel nothing but physical tiredness. You don't want anything at all. If you did get anything, what would you do with it? Don't you realize that you're going to die? Each day, try to think of death. You're going to die. You know that, don't you?" Lumpur went on like this at great length before turning around and asking me, "Do rich people die? Do poor people die?" "Yes, they all die," I answered irritably. "Well then, don't you think you're going to die? The poor die, and so do the rich. You have to be liberated before you can be happy. So what's to be done? He ended up asking me a question as usual. Become a monk, I said, thinking it was a pretty intelligent answer. If you become a monk, will you be free of suffering if you don't practice? Karma means action. We do good, we do evil. If we do good, then we get good results. If we do evil, then we get evil results. So what's there to do except do good? And that's what you're doing. I brought you to do good because passing through trials and tribulations will lead you beyond suffering. That afternoon, we came to a village, stopped for a rest in one of the adjoining fields. There were people around grazing their cattle, and they came over. Lumpo said to me, get some soft drinks. Bring over 3 or 4 packs. I got angry. I wanted to keep the money, and he was having me buy drinks for buffalo herders. In the end, they couldn't finish it all, and he told them to take the remainder home with them. When we got back to the monastery, he asked me, how much money is left? We need bricks and cement. I said, it would have been a better idea to keep the whole lot for bricks and cement instead of spending it on soft drinks. No, he said, that would have been a bad idea because we wouldn't have practiced giving and the buffalo grazers wouldn't have had their drink. They were tired and they must have been thirsty. When you drank some, you were refreshed, weren't you? Yes, I replied sheepishly. Well then, he said, and started off on yet another sermon. When we make others happy, it makes us happy. When you receive that kind of happiness, then what more do you want? You have to raise your mind up high. When the floods come, only the houses built on higher land stay dry. If you indulge in low, coarse things, then your mind becomes baser. And whatever you do, you'll never see the Dhamma. So, the last passage here. this is a laywoman's account of going to pay respects to Lumpo at Tam Sengpet, and that's the last year, the last pansa before his operation and before his health started to go seriously downhill. And as for those of you may guess, the attendant monk who makes an appearance towards the end is none other than Joseph, ex-Ajahn Prabhakara. So this is Me Somjai. Lumpo walked very slowly across the rocky area between the Dhamma hall and the kitchen on arms round. As soon as he appeared, everyone converged on him to put food into his bowl. Those who hadn't brought any food with them or were too late to prepare it in time for alms round squatted on the ground, hands in Anjali, expressing regret missing the opportunity. At least they would get the chance to offer their food in the Dhamma hall at the mealtime. After Lumpur had taken his meal, everybody waited for him to come out and talk to all the visitors in the Dhamma hall. A huge number of people had arrived, and a steady stream came throughout the day. In the evening, it was a bit better. Most of the people who'd come during the day had returned. I listened to Lumpo give teachings from early evening onwards. He didn't sit on the Dhamma seat, but on his usual seat on the monk's platform. He taught in a relaxed, informal way, interspersed with chat with various of his guests. I remember at one point in his talk, Lumpo was talking about making mindfulness continual, and to show us what he meant, he lifted his kettle and poured out the water, at first in drops, and then in a steady stream. It was one of the similes that he was fond of using in his talks. When it was time for him to rest, his attendant monk invited him to return to his kuti. We all just held our breath, afraid that he would leave us. It seemed like he'd only just started talking. Lumpur smiled at the monk, but didn't get up, and after a few minutes, continued his talk for a while longer. The attendant politely repeated to Lumpo that he should rest now, and we all groaned aloud. It was like a plea and a protest at the same time. Lumpo smiled again, said to the attendant monk, I'll give them just a bit more. And he carried on until finally it must really have been time. This time, when the attendant monk invited him, he spoke in quite a firm voice, and he picked up Lumpo's walking stick. He stood there with his torch in his hand, to show that he was ready to take Lumpur back to his kuti. The attendant turned to us all and said, "It's already far past the time." Lumpur smiled once more, comforting us like a father, and said, "They won't give me any more time. I suppose I'll have to go." It was as if the whole Dhamma hall sighed with dismay. The time had flown by. It seemed we'd only been listening to him for a few minutes. I'd heard a Dhamma talk from Lumpur's own mouth for the first time, and I was utterly satisfied, but I still wanted to hear more. So that's the end of the readings.